sit back and get ready to take off with Dynamic Golf.
Are you guys ready?
I'm ready to go. Yeah, so, all right. Welcome, listeners. Welcome to Dynamic Golf Podcast. I'm your co-host, Tim McElvanna. With me is my fellow co-host, Sean Klotz. And today, Sean, please let us know, what is our guest for today?
This one's about 40 years in the making, T-Mac, which is kind of interesting. But, we some of the listeners know that I've moved up here to Oakley Country Club in Watertown, Mass, from Peabody, Mass, originally. And my boss, my head professional at Oakley Country Club is Scott Johnson, and we're just excited to have him. So Scott, just introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners and kind of tell them who you are a little bit and where you came from. No pressure.
No pressure. My name's Scott Johnson. I've been at Oakley Country Club for the last 25 years. Been in the golf industry for 36 years now. Six other clubs prior to coming to Oakley in 1999. Grew up playing golf my whole life, learned from a brother who allowed me to play when we first snuck onto a golf course, and got the bug when I was 13 years old and have had it ever since. I eat golf, I sleep golf, I dream about playing better golf. I'm a golf addict for sure.
Wow. And yeah. You've been a PGA pro since 94, is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
Nice.
He snuck on golf courses like me and you used to, too. That's just so, we were talking beforehand because we work together every day, but then I'm like, just kind of prepping him a little bit for what we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny, like, how we all kind of come from that same little background of, like, my brother's 5 years older. My brother is the same age and class as Scott. So they went to Peabody High School together, and they went to University of Tampa. My brother came back after a year, but that's how I've known Scott since I was 12. But I would always tag along with my brother, working balls in the backyard or, going down to the local golf course, cutting through the fence that we're not supposed to be. And Scott was telling the same story with his brother.
It was funny growing up. My brother's 10 years older than I was. So all his buddies were playing golf, and he was babysitting, quote unquote, me. So he would drag me to the golf course, and I would either carry the bag or put it on a push cart and carry it. And that was at a public golf course in Salem, Mass, called Salem Muni. So I would sneak on there. Then as I got older, I lived near Salem Country Club, which is a top 100 in the United States. We would ride our bikes up with our bags on our back, ditch our bikes in the woods, and then we'd sneak on to Salem and play number 7, 8, 16. We'd skip around and play a few holes and just, doing everything that kids do. And that's where I learned the game. Then I went on to caddy, and I worked in the bag room at Salem, and then I worked as an assistant at a number of different clubs, and I've been in the business forever.
You've got to have a real passion for it, don't you, Scott? I mean, you find a bug for it, and you find any way to get out there to play it. You find any way to get into the industry of it. Everybody I find that gets into this industry has either some sibling or somebody, an older mentor that gets them into the game, and they really get a big bug for it. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's in your blood. Mm-hmm. If you love the game and you want to be in the industry, you find a way to get in the industry. It's either as a golf professional or it's as a sales rep. If you love it and are passionate about it, and you can see it in people when they're into it and love the industry and they're
engaged.
They're engaged. Right. That's the word I use all the time.
Yeah.
It's funny. We're at a private club here, and I always tell my staff, I said, we're not in customer service. We're in hospitality. Any club pro who tells you they're in customer service, they're not doing it right, because we're in hospitality. This is about anticipating people's wants and needs before they know they want them or need them.
Yes.
That's what hospitality is.
Correct. And the experience that those members or people have when they come to your facility, correct?
Correct. That's what we provide.
Gotcha.
We want it to be an experience when you come here, either as a member on a regular basis or as a guest. It should be a special opportunity.
Yeah. So kind of like that Disney. I always come back to the Disney idea. When you go there, it's like it's your home away from home. And everybody's kind of there to greet you and say hello. And I think that's kind of like the feeling I get when I get to Augusta or something like that. So yeah.
Yep. You ever seen a negative Disney employee? I don't think there's too many working there. right?
Yeah, they're gone in a hurry. They're back in the cast room or wherever they call that.
They're smiling. Yeah, exactly. They're smiling and like Scott said, just anticipating needs. So it doesn't matter if it's public, semi-private, you know, private. Mm-hmm. The people are here for the 4 to 5 hours, and they're trying to get away from their life for 4 to 5 hours.
Yeah,
partially, right? They're trying to work on their own game. Some reasons people play golf because they weren't good at team sports. So that would be me.
Yeah.
You know, like I wanted all the glory and all the fame, and I also wanted all the negatives. And I knew if I needed to go practice, it was just me. You didn't need to grab, you know, 5 or 6 others to play basketball or play baseball.
But it's also a social hub too for a lot of people too as well. You know, it's definitely a home away from home. You know, instead of sitting around the house and futzing about, they're out there with their friends, engaging with the you know, the club pro or the employees there or even the maintenance staff. They just find it as a home. You know, I always find, at least in that industry.
I'll give you a quick story. This goes back a long time. My first year in the business. It's an August day. I'm working outside, running the cart barn, and the cart barn's about 70 yards away at Tedesco Country Club. Well, I'm the only one working. It's really busy, and it's about 102 degrees. So I'm running back and forth, pulling carts, getting people ready, and a member, Greg Keating, comes around the corner. I forget his first name, but I think it's Greg, comes around the corner, and he says to me, "How you doing today?" And I said, "I'm doing pretty good, Mr. Keating. How are you?" He says, "On such a hot day, you're doing okay." Little do I know, my boss, who I've been working for 4 months, is standing in the doorway listening to the interaction. Hmm. And I said, "If you really want to know, Mr. Keating, my day sucks." I go, "It's 104 degrees. I'm the only one working. I'm sweating my ass off, and it's busy. And we're going back and forth." And I put his clubs on a cart. He goes out to play, and the golf professional, still one of my closest friends in the business, is mm-hmm. Bob Green. He calls me in his office. He says, "Close the door." I'm thinking, "Huh? I've been here 4 months. He's never closed the door." I walk in, close the door. He says, "What did you say to Keating?" And I said, you know, he asked me how my day was going. And I told him. He said, "What did you tell him exactly?" I said, "Well, my day kind of sucks." He says, "I don't care. They don't care. Yeah. The minute you close your door in the parking lot, I don't care if your cat died, you had a fight with your girlfriend, you put a smile on your face and you come to work."
Yep.
That lesson is 36 years old. I tell that story 10 times a year. My staff can recite it back to me because it was so invaluable to me in my career. I've never forgotten it.
Yep.
And it is the basis of my professional career.
T-Mac, the funny part of the story is that he told us that speech literally the day my cat died. like my cat died the day before I started working here, and on a Tuesday in March, and he tells the story, and he's like, sorry, Sean, it's just always part of the speech. It is.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that your cat died. I didn't even know about that.
So. Exactly. Yeah, we'll have the therapy session later. Okay.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, with such a rich history there at Oakley Country Club, I mean, I'm just kind of looking through the history here, Scott. I mean, you've got people like, you know, the Roosevelts have played there. Bobby Jones played there. I mean, can you touch a little bit on the history of that course that you've been at for so many years, 21 years, I think it is now?
It's actually year 25 for me.
25, and okay, sorry.
The most famous part about this, Tim, is it's Donald Ross's original golf course. Yeah. He came over from Scotland in 1899, walked from where he sailed to in downtown Boston, walked out here 4 miles, had nothing to his name, became the green superintendent, and then went on from here. He worked here for 11 years as the club pro and the superintendent, and then he went on to his career after that.
Wow.
Most, by far the most famous person we've had here. We've had a ton of famous players. We've had a ton of famous women. Mm-hmm. The Curtises have played here. These are big names in the Massachusetts golf history. Mike Ohanian. Fred Wright Jr. won the state amateur 7 times, I believe. We've had a rich history here, both men's and women's golf. It's really, it's a staple in the New England area for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you just look at the history that, you know, cause I'm looking at the website that you guys have, which is a great website. If anybody gets a chance to take a look at it, but the history through time, the, you know, everything that comes through is absolutely amazing. So, I mean, It's just got to be great to, you know, it's got to be a joy to go to something that's just so rich with history and knowing that you're contributing to that history as you go through the halls.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it. I'm fortunate to work for such a great membership for such a long period of time. In this day and age, as you both know, that it's hard to be a club pro at one club for more than 8, 10, 12 years. I'm a bit of a dinosaur at this point, having been here for 25 years. Again, I work for a great membership, so it's really not very difficult to keep them happy.
But it's cool, T-Mac. They honor their history, meaning, like, currently we're taking applications for the Fred Wright Golf Tournament that's coming up, right? That's a 3-day member guest, right? We just got done with Donahue Cup qualifying, which is named after a pro who was here for 34 years, Paul Donahue.
Paul Donahue. Yeah.
Later in the summer, we're going to have the Johnson Cup Golf Tournament. Johnson Cup, and that's named after Scott Johnson. That 2 years ago,
when did they start that? 8 years.
Eight years ago.
Oh wow!
Pretty cool.
Congratulations. Yeah, that's pretty stout stuff right there.
It's pretty odd, yeah. I owe it to a gentleman named John Coughlin and another one named Fred DeVito who wanted to run another what we call plaque tournament, which this is an individual quota event that runs throughout the year, and my boss at the time was Coughlin, and he said, "Hey, Scott, here, we're going to unveil this plaque. Can you hold it?" And I said, "Sure." And I'm holding the plaque, and it's got a tablecloth over it. And my staff at the time happened to be there, unbeknownst to them and me. He says, "Okay, we got the individual quota tournament. Scott, why don't you unveil that?" And I looked down, and it says Johnson Cup on it. And I went, I looked at my boss, and I said, "I'm going to kill you." And my staff is in the corner, Tim, and they are laughing because – my job is to provide a service to the membership, and I call it fly under the radar. I don't like the spotlight. It's not my personality. And to name a tournament after me was a little bit bold. I cringe most of the time. I'm like, you could have named it after a number of different people who've been here for a long period of time. It is a tremendous honor.
Yeah.
It's an absolute tremendous honor, and that's a tremendous amount of respect from my membership for me, and I truly appreciate it.
Yeah.
But it's a big tournament, and I'm just kind of trying to stay out of the way and do my job.
Gotcha. That's great. So congratulations there, Scott. That's great.
Thank you.
So
some of the stuff we talk about TMAC too is like, again, kind of history, some of the things that are done different at Oakley. So I'm going to let Scott touch on this, but the caddy program at Oakley Club, kind of like, above and beyond what, and I think two things as I see it from the outsider now starting to become the insider, the members are gracious with their acceptance, we'll call it, and time and willingness to realize that we've got these 12 to 16 year old kids, and there might be 30 of them on the bench, T-Mac, on a Saturday morning, literally on the bench, like just picture Caddyshack audience. It's the same thing, right? There's not a caddy master. Right, there's no Bill Murray going around there trying to fight the groundhog. Pat does a good job with that, right? Our superintendent, but it is. It's a caddy principal, caddy program, and Scott's just he's been a beacon in the industry on this program, and he accepted the WeMet Scholarship Pro of the Year in 2019.
I did.
Yeah, so go ahead and talk about that, Scott, a little bit.
Yeah, please.
Our program's been running for 25 years. I grew up as a caddy at Salem Country Club, and I was the small kid that always went out last because I was short and had trouble carrying bags, or they thought I did. And then I worked my way up into the caddy ranks, and it is the best way to learn the game for most kids. So when I became the head professional here, we had a limited caddy program, and we've increased it every year. We promote it. We train them over school vacation for 8 hours of training, and then they get the opportunity to go out and caddy. Now, do we have all success stories? No. If we train 35 kids, if we get a dozen that are really good caddies, that's a pretty productive year. If you hit on 30%, we're doing well.
Gotcha.
We've done that. And one of the big carrots at the end, and these are kids, remember, 12 to 15, 16 years old. They don't understand this part. In Massachusetts, we have the WeMet Scholarship Fund, and it provides scholarships to caddies who caddy for 2 years or work on the ground staff for 2 years, they're eligible to get that based on need. Last year, the WEMET gave out over $3 million to over, I think it's 300 kids. I mean, it's an amazing number. Wow. The scholarship used to range between 2 and 5 a year. Now they range between 4 and 15 a year based on need. And it's every year. Unlike some scholarship funds where you get it for 1 year and it goes away, this one is if you get it, whatever year you get it, every year thereafter until you graduate college, I'm sorry, it's 4 years. In the 4 years, you get it, and it goes up every year.
Oh, that's amazing.
You probably have heard of the Evans Scholarship out in the middle of the country. And similar to that, only this one, Evans is they do it for smaller numbers. This one hits a lot of kids. It's an outstanding program.
The membership, by the way, also embrace it by donating money, right? Yeah. What's the number there, 100 grand that Oakley gives?
Oakley gives about $50,000 annually to the WEMET Scholarship Fund.
Wow.
So over the 25 years here, the club has been fortunate. Yes, they've given over $1 million. Wow. And we've been fortunate to have probably slightly over 100 WEMET scholars, which is one of the things I'm most proud of, not only for me. I appreciated the WEMET award, but this is an award that's club-wide, meaning my membership contributes to it, and then my caddies participate in getting it. It's a really big deal, and it's one of the most things I'm most proud about being a part of the Oakley Country Club family.
Yeah. I mean, that's tremendous support that you're getting from your membership. That's amazing right there, the numbers that they're putting out. So, you know, one of the questions I was going to ask is how's the support of the membership there contribute to the scholarship program? But that answered it right there for everybody. That's amazing what they're able to contribute to your cause and what they're able to do. That's amazing.
It is.
That's great stuff. And it's just, again, something that separates, you know, we talk about hospitality versus customer service. That's like something that separates, you know, Oakley Country Club from another golf course in the area. And there's a lot of great golf courses. People have choices, but people want to join this country club for a reason, you know, and that's one of them, honestly. It's been great to kind of see it in action. And the staff, not myself yet, but the other staff member, Scott and Darren do just such a good job of getting the kids out, whether we have a tournament. Last Friday, we had a tournament, member guest. Mm-hmm. We got the kids out. Sometimes they're 4 caddies TMAC, which kind of goes kind of like the, you know, unsung hero type of thing. You don't always have to caddy.
Yeah.
The 4 caddy program is just, you know, equally another way to teach the kids, which a lot of people in the audience may not know what that is, but essentially you're just having the kid go out, boys or girls, by the way. There's been plenty of girls that have won this scholarship too, right? You know, you're going out in the middle of the fairway. And what I hear from the membership, when that happens, oh my gosh, we should have this all the time because we find the golf balls, you know?
Well, and it keeps the kid engaged. It lets them see the course. You know, they might not, you know, not every person that comes on a golf course has the skill or ability, but they have the love for it. So find a position and a spot for them. And yeah, I think that's a great way for somebody that might just be beginning the game to start out.
It's funny. They make real money too. It's really good.
Oh.
Especially for a 12, 13, 14-year-old making, you know, $100 in a day. It's like, okay, that's a pretty good wage. Many of those kids from my caddy program will go on to work in my bag room, and they'll work for me all through high school into college. I've been incredibly fortunate. I've had some guys work for me for 8 or 9 years, all through high school, all through college. One of them is named Chris McGuire. He worked for me for 9 years, and now is back. He's a full member. So I'm getting to see some of these kids go through the program and come back as members now, which is pretty, it's outstanding is what it is.
Wow. Wow. Can you, are there any significant impacts on any students' lives that you've kind of seen with this program, you know, with that gentleman? I mean, but have you seen something where it kind of like, you know, turn the kid around a little bit, big changes for somebody or anybody like that maybe?
I don't know if I've seen like
maybe underprivileged kids.
I don't know if I could name anybody specifically that way. I can tell you it's funny to watch. A kid named Max, never been on a golf course in his life ever. And he came through caddy program when he was 14 years old and he wanted to go to NYU. Okay. So this kid caddied AM and PM. He'd caddy in the morning And in the start, obviously, he was carrying singles. And by August of that year, his first year, he was carrying doubles. He would carry doubles in the morning, and then he would carry singles in the afternoon. Wow. So he was doing this every Saturday and Sunday. This kid, in his first year, made like $5,000 towards his education. I love when a caddy has a goal. Yeah. I want a new set of clubs. I want to go to college. I want to buy new bikes or whatever they want, because they're motivated. And again, this goes back to something Sean said earlier. It's about engagement. And if you can get either, you know, my staff engaged with the membership, or I can get my kids, my caddy program engaged with the membership, and they're motivated. I want those guys. That's who I want on my staff. And you know a kid who's motivated. He's here all the time. Mm-hmm. We caddy on Friday afternoon, Saturday and Sunday mornings, and the kids who are on the bench on a regular basis, they want to get better, and they want to do a good job, and they do. And the better job they do, obviously, the more money these kids make. They make real money. It's pretty impressive. Nice. Membership is ridiculously generous to the program.
So in Silverado world, which I know is a little bit micro, like it's a Silverado Golf and Country Club in Zephyr Hills, mm-hmm. of T-Mac when I were there, if we had a program like that for Zeke Kinsman,
yeah.
or for Nora, remember like Nora, the 11-year-old phenom,
mm-hmm.
right? She ended up going to Augusta, right?
So she qualified. Drive, chip, and putt.
Right. So if we had a program kind of like that for those types of kids in that area, especially, I'm going to say the word, a little more on the underprivileged side.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, you see some of the inner city workings, how it works in some of the programs, maybe at more like a, what's the municipal?
Cleveland Heights or something like that?
Yeah, Cleveland Heights and Lakeland, right? Yeah. That type of thing. Or
Rogers Park.
Rogers Park would be a good one.
Rogers Park would be a great one. I spent some time there in my I spent 3 years of college career at Rogers Park.
So let's move into his playing career that he's very excited and humble to talk about. Hates talking about it. But bottom line, Scott, hey, how many times were you All-American at University of Tampa, Scott?
Yeah, love to hear it.
I was a two-time All-American and a honorable mention All-American once.
And the team won?
Two national championships back-to-back in 87 and 88.
Yeah.
I played with some great players, guys who went on to play on tour, guys who were just won the national mid-AM. It was a program that was spectacular.
Wow.
I call it the Fab Five, T-Mac. And to me, it was that confluence of just five guys from all over different parts of the country
mm-hmm.
going to a Division II school that really wasn't known for golf specifically.
It was pure luck that we all got together. And again, here's that, we're going to go back to engagement. You couldn't have found, and it wasn't just, we had five guys who played on a regular, we had 11 or 12 guys that were
pushing each other.
Engaged. Yeah. It was who's going to get better faster. And it wasn't cutthroat or at all, but it was challenging. And I got to play with Jeff Leonard, who played on tour for 3 years. And Jeff Leonard in 1988 was the number two player in the country, stroke average, behind Bob Estes from U Texas.
Yeah.
This kid was the best player in the country. It was amazing. This kid could do it all. And he came out of Indianapolis, went to Tampa to play golf, play baseball, messed up an elbow, and then he had played a little golf in high school and then went on to become basically the best player in the country those last couple of years. It was pretty amazing.
Wow. Amazing. That is amazing right there.
We've talked about him a few times on the podcast already, right?
Well, we saw him swing it out there in Orlando, didn't we?
Wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, very unassuming, you know, you wouldn't think, you know, definitely white man can't jump kind of guy. You're like, I'm going to get this guy. And boy, he will eat you for lunch. You can tell.
Grew up in Indianapolis,
mm-hmm.
great family, very unassuming. And won't tell you he's going to kill you. I played with Lee Jansen and Rocco, and they were a little more, and Hugh Royer up at Columbus College. They were more in your face. They were really good players.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff was at least as good, if not better than those guys. Jeff would never say a word about himself. The other guys were like, it was an advertisement. Hey, look at me. And I love Jeff for that. Still a close friend of mine, just a tremendous person and a tremendous player. Did
you play with Kraft too? Greg Kraft?
Yeah, I played with Greg Kraft for a season. Greg Kraft's
cheat. PJ guy.
He played on tour for 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kraft's name was Cheese Whiz because of Kraft, obviously.
Okay.
Kraft was an amazing player, but a guy who humble was not in his vocabulary. And I don't really, sorry, Greg, but that's who you are. And you're probably still part of it.
Yeah. I don't know if he's listening yet to our podcast. Yeah, we're okay. Probably getting onto it. So from college, then did you try any mini tour? Try for a couple of years? What'd you do?
Tried for the year pretty much after 88.
Okay.
I came out, I played all the New England stuff. Jeff Schroeder and I, my college teammate, we traveled together all summer, played all the opens. I did fairly well.
Yeah.
Okay. I finished in the top 10, you know, I never won anything big, but I was a pretty good player. Then I went back to Florida. I said I was going to go play for the year. I ran into Jeff Gallagher III at Disney, and we were paired the first two rounds together at a mini tour event, and I played pretty good. I shot 71-69, and he shot 65-64. He hit it further than I did. He hit it more in the middle of the fairway than I did. He hit it closer than I did. He putted it better than I did. And he had sponsorship money. I said, okay, all right. And this is just one guy. I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to do this? And that was up through May. And then I had my name out up here in Massachusetts on the New England PGA board for a job. And out of the blue, on June 1st, the guy at Tedesco Country Club, Bob Green, the one I shared that story about parking your car and putting on a happy face, called and said, hey, I need somebody. And I lived in the town next door, and I went to work for him. I only worked for Bobby for one season before I went down to Milton to go to Wollaston Golf Club. And it put me in the business, and I realized at that point I could play locally at a pretty high level. And did for a long time, but I wasn't going to play on TV. It just, A, I didn't hit it far enough, and B, I didn't have the sponsorship behind me to do it. So for me, it was an opportunity that I jumped on, and here I am today.
Wow.
Pretty impressive resume right there, mm-hmm. T-Mac. So talk to the listeners, Scott, a little bit about your Wollaston, your U.S. Juniors experience. I think that's a good one for the listeners to hear.
Yeah.
1992, I'm down at Wollaston Golf Club in Milton, and we're holding the U.S. Junior, and it's Tiger's second year. So he won he was 15 years old, and he won at Lake Merced, I think. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were hosting in 92, and we're out there, and he comes down to play.
16-year-old Tiger, by the way.
Yes.
Right?
Skinny as a stick,
right?
Yeah. All decked out in all Nike stuff, and he gets to know me a little bit because the other assistant who was working at the time had to go in for emergency hip surgery, so he was in the hospital, so he wasn't around much. And I had myself and a guy named Dana Smith, and we were there to run the event. And Tiger found me one early on in the week and said, "Hey, can I get down to the range?" And I would take him down. Walston had two ends of the range. He liked to hit at the far end of the range where there were less people. So I would bring him down. And I'll never forget, we're driving. It's about a half a mile to the far end of the range. We're driving down. He's got a sports psychologist on the back of the car. We're driving down. I looked at him. I said, what's it like to be you? And he turned and said, everybody wants a piece of me. Everybody wants to touch me. And I said, oh. And now right there I knew that I just wanted to leave him alone. And I would bring down the other end of the range, and I'm standing there one day. I said, "Tiger, do you care if I watch you hit balls?" He goes, "No." So I stood off to the side, and I got to see Tiger Woods hit balls for 30 straight minutes, me, him, and his caddy. That's it. And it was different. Even then, you knew it was different. It sounded different when he hit it. And then he went out. Then he goes on to play, and he is, prior to the final round, he gets in the final round. I think he's playing Marco Wilson. And we're getting ready to go off he's getting ready to go off to the first tee, and the other assistant, Mike Bemis, is the kid with the bad hip, is banged up. He's in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Tiger, I said, "Could you do me a favor and meet the other assistant?" So he came in, and as we're walking in, this is when we had metal spikes. We had a tile floor. T- Tiger almost takes a Dixie. He has to grab onto the bag rack so he doesn't fall down. I'm thinking, I'm going to wreck this kid's back before we even get to play.
Wow.
So he came over and he met Mike Nemus, and he couldn't have been more of a gentleman. He said, hey, Michael, I'm glad you're here. I hope you get to see some of the final match. I hope to see you on the golf course. He was great. Now, whether you love Tiger or you don't.
I'm a big Tiger fan.
He was terrific. So we go out and we're watching the match. And we're on the 16th hole at Wollaston, which is a par 5. He is now 2 down with 3 to go. So pins in the back right. I'm with Tom Meeks, who at the time was running the USGA. We're in the cart together. And we're out in the fairway, and Tiger hits it in the pin to his back right. And he hits it on the back fringe. And he spins it back through the fringe to about 4 feet. He makes it for 4, wins all. Now he's 1 down with 2 to go. Okay, the next hole is really difficult. Par 3, he makes 3. Wilson makes 4. We go to 18, we're even. Mark Wilson throws up on himself, makes 6. Tiger makes bogey and wins.
Okay.
And that's how he won his second U.S. junior down at Wollaston. It was pretty phenomenal.
That's amazing.
But you'd heard of this kid. And then to see it in person was outstanding even then. And now, you look where he is now.
Did you have a good sense? I mean, you had a sense when you watched him then that he was going to have the career that he was going to have, or did you think it might have been a little hyped up a little bit, or did you say this kid's the real deal and I'm going to see him crush some records?
You knew he was the real deal when you watched him hit it, when you heard him hit it. So this kid's 16 years old, and the sound it made at 16 was different than anything pretty much I'd ever heard from any player, whether they were adult or a child. He hit it flush almost every single swing, which is pretty amazing. Because later on, when he was a Titleist guy, he went down, I can remember this, he went down to Manchester Lane, and they said, early in his career, he hit it, he swung the fastest, and he hit it most in the center of any tour pro they'd ever tested. Well, at that point, even before that, when we saw him down there, you knew how good he was. You knew how amazing he was. And then to hear that stat afterwards about him down at Titleist and how centered he hit it and how, no wonder he was good. As long as he could putt it, which clearly he can, he was going to do something special. And he was. Yeah. He was.
That's amazing. That's amazing right there.
Cool. That was a pretty good story, right, T-Mac?
I was captivated. I'm sitting here all quiet.
Exactly. So, Scott, you've got, as we kind of conveniently just talk, you've got 4 course records that you can remember. He's got 1 up here, T-Mac. He's got 62. There's 2 other players who've had 62 at Oakley.
Jeff Bailey, previous pro, and Paul Donahue, both shot 62 here at Oakley. Yeah,
that's 8 under for the record.
Wow.
So my question is,
what time it was 9?
Was it 9 under? 71. Oh, okay, my bad. Sorry. I mean, that's kind of a stroke there. So my question to you is, because my low is 64. I've done it a couple times in my life. T-Mac, you've had some low rounds, like Scott, to you. When you get to that zone, when you're in those areas of like that 5-6 under, and now arguably for us now at our age, it might be 2-3 under.
Yes.
Right. Like kind of the bars change a little bit, but like what, how do you get there? Sort of how do you stay there? Maybe for the listener, sort of the guy who's trying to break 90, right? The lady who's trying to break 100, whatever that is. What's that sort of thing that you can kind of give them? You always hear stay in the present, those kinds of things. Like, don't think ahead, whatever.
It's a lovely catchphrase. It's really difficult to do. Think about what's in front of you and don't count how many players we have that are out here and they know they're playing pretty well. So they're on 16 and they add up the scorecard. They're like, well, if I make 3 pars, I'm going to shoot 75. Or I'm going to shoot 85 and I'm going to break 90 for the first time. They're toast at that point. Once your brain gets involved, now your brain's involved when you're playing golf, obviously, but try to play each hole independently and put down the scores in the box and then add them up after 18. Don't add them up after 9 if you do it. I did this. I was a score guy. I'd add it up when I was younger. 5 years ago, my daughter got sick big time. And I was playing golf at that point was more
therapy.
Respite, therapy. So I went out and I started to play some big events up here, and I finished 2nd on our section championship at Myopia and Tedesco, and I played very well. And the key to this one was I stopped adding up scores at that point, because I really didn't care whether I made a three-footer or missed a three-footer. My daughter was in real jeopardy. It didn't matter as much. So the phrase care less and play better golf is really a true statement, where the only one who really cares about how well you play is you personally.
Yeah.
Because the guy you're playing with is trying to beat you, and the other two guys are trying to play against you. It's all, golf is, as Sean said, it's an individual sport. Yeah. That's another reason I reached out to it too. I was a baseball player and a hockey player, and I didn't want somebody to make a mistake and cost us the game. Here, you make a mistake in golf, it's all on you. I like that part of the game. I like that I can practice on my own. But to stay in the present is to just look forward and hit the next shot and not worry about the result and not worry about the score. Just play the next shot and don't add up your score. If I could teach my membership, just put the numbers in the boxes, add them up at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. The second round of that section championship was at Tedesco Country Club. And I'm playing with a guy named Jeff Stewart. The other guy bailed out, so it's just the two of us, so it's a little slow. We play. I think I'm playing okay. I haven't just writing down the boxes, and I go in and I hand a scorecard to my numbers are correct. I still haven't had the totals. I hand it to the guy behind the computer. He keys it in. He looks up at me and says, great round, 69. I said, okay. And I didn't know that I had shot 69, but that was the mentality I need to have when I play golf, and I wish more of us did that. Well, you don't count. And if you don't count, you're not going to worry about the score as much. But people, we are score driven.
Yeah.
Now, what you make on that hole, and I love the guy, Tim. My favorite is the guy. He's your buddy. Mm-hmm. And Sean's playing with me. We're buddies. And I play great on the front. I shoot 4 under. And he can't wait to tell me on the 10th tee, hey, you know, you're 4 under?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a really good story out here about me. I shoot 29 on the front one day, playing with 3 members. 10 at the time was a par 5. It's now a par 4. But at the time, I make 4. So I'm 8 under after 10. And the member walked into the 11th tee, says, you know, you're going to break the course record today. I had 3 bogeys coming in and the end of that show.
Yeah.
But in that, what it does is it takes you out of just playing golf, and now you're thinking about score and all that stuff. Correct. It's totally different. You really need to not think about score and just hit the shot in front of you, and that's all you can do.
Well, it kind of like going back to the idea of if somebody's throwing a no-hitter, you don't go down to the pitcher and say, hey, by the way, you just need 3 more outs and you get this no-hitter. I mean, nobody does that, right? So, I mean, I think you just – when somebody's in the zone, at least when I see somebody in the zone like that, I'm trying to play – out of their way and be quiet. If that 100%. Makes sense.
We played here. We do a pro member every few years, and I had my buddies come in and we're playing. And one of the guys I'm playing with, you guys did a podcast with Jerry York. His mm-hmm. brother Billy's playing with me. Well, Billy never broke an 80, and he's in my group. And right now we got 2 par 3s, 14 and 15 to finish. And he's gonna do is go bogey, bogey to finish, mm-hmm. and he's gonna shoot 78. So I know this because I'm sitting in the cart with one of my guys, and one of my guys, the cart guy I'm riding with, says, hey, should we tell him? I go, if you tell him, I'm going to kill you. And he went on. He made 4-3, and he shot 78, I think it was, and it was the first time he'd ever broken 80, and it was during an event. So it was, like they were gimmies. These were like real putts. I was like, it was phenomenal. But when you're in that zone, if somebody tells you, talks about it, how about when you make 3 birdies in a row? Hey, you know, you made 3 birdies in a row, yeah. You know. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, I mean, come on, I'm paying attention here. Oh, you know, you're going to make another one? I have no idea. I'm just going to go play golf and just hit the next one. But we get too caught up in numbers, and we get, you know, just play the game. Play the next shot. Play the next hole.
Right, right. And I think you also see that with, you know, just kind of turning over to lessons. You know, sometimes when I see lessons, I try to tell them, hey, we got to go through a process here, but they get so result driven, you know, I think, you know, with numbers and results that people want, we live in that world of instant gratification. We want to see something, you know, low. We want to see something, you know, go straight. Yep. You know, they just don't take the time to make a process of it, I think.
That one drives me a little bananas as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The quick fix guy, Tim, the guy who comes in and says, you know, my game's a mess. Fix me. Huh? Wait a minute, bud. Well, your grip's terrible. Your posture's bad. Your backswing's out of place, and you make a decent follow through. Okay, well, can you fix them all at once? No, I can't. I can't. And it's hard. We do a fair amount of teaching, and mm-hmm. you can't overwhelm people. If you give them too much stuff,
you
get them lost, and then they're like, my game stinks. You got to keep it simple.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. But it's pretty, let's keep it basic. There's, fundamentals in golf swings that everybody has. You better have a good grip. Yeah. You better have a good posture, good backswing to set up a good downswing. That's pretty much a teaching philosophy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those fundamentals need a hold.
I got two things to add to that, T-Mac and listeners. So my first story is my dad passed away in 2007. Greatest guy in my life. Scott's known him since he was a kid. Came over for breakfast, and he just knew my dad. And that's part of the legacy between the two of us, which was great. So I'm at Green Valley Country Club in 2008, the first Father's Day after my dad passed. Mm-hmm. I shoot 36 in the front, ho-hum, life is great, things are good. I go eagle, birdie, birdie on the next five holes.
Wow.
Seven under. Member on number 15 tee box says to me, "Hey, you know you're seven under?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do. I wish you hadn't said anything to me." And I wheel it in for seven under on the back nine and shoot whatever the number was, 64 or whatever. But it was just kind of a funny, like, and I hear Scott tell the story. We all have those. Like, the birdie thing is great. Like, mm-hmm. just the reason, hey, you almost want to say to the 15 handicap guy, like, look, the reason I'm here is because I already know all this. Like, you don't need to add to that.
Correct.
So then the other part of that story is my brother. I like this concept when he teaches, especially beginners, mm-hmm. he'll go do a playing lesson. And on the scorecard, all he's writing down is how many good shots that person's hit in a hole.
Okay.
But before, just, hey, you're on a par five and you hit two good shots, he writes down two.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to approach, especially as you're trying to break these barriers of 100, mm-hmm. 95, 90, 80. Like, forget that number. I hate par on a scorecard because it's for 1% of the population.
Yeah.
Correct. That's the problem. Correct. I mean, as golf professionals, and I don't ever think this way, but one of my assistants, Scott, said, we're in the top 1% of the golfers in the world because mm-hmm. we can break 80 on a regular basis, but we can also break 70 here and there.
Yep.
And most people, I mean, they marvel at us, yep. and think, and the only reason we got here and we were as good as we are is because we put the time in.
Yes.
I wish people would put more time in. The yep. game is, the game gives you, not immediately, yep. it may take a little while, but it will give back to you if you put the effort in. And people in this world, instant gratification, mm-hmm. I want it now. They don't put in enough work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I definitely agree with that.
As you can tell, T-Mac, we probably need to schedule a part two with Scott because he's got a ton of information in his head.
He does. He does. A lot of a wealth of knowledge right there, a lot of history. To go
yep,
through,
yep.
Just an amazing stories of Tiger and everybody like that. I think we need to schedule up part two, maybe next week or in a week or so or something like that. This was enjoyable. I enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Tim. I really enjoyed it.
All we did was we touched on Donald Ross, Tiger Woods, and Coach Jerry York. We're doing pretty good today, T-Mac.
Right, and I think we fixed a few people's swings with some mental imagery and trying to stay in the zone. And if your buddy's in the zone, don't make a lot of noise. Just be quiet. Yeah, leave him alone, man. Yeah. Let him have his no-ball.
That's correct. Exactly.
Great, man. Great.
So I want to thank Scott for joining us. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for listening to us here at Dynamic Golf. Sean, any last words before we break?
No, I like what you just said. Just, play within yourself, play within your zone, have a good time, keep score when you have to, but otherwise just keep working on your game and put into it what you want to get out of it, bottom line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the big thing is it takes time to develop these movement patterns, and if you don't put them in, you don't get them out.
Last thing I will say, because I gave two lessons this morning, the reason why you go to get a golf lesson is so you have a plan.
Yeah.
Period. Right.
Right.
Like the reason why people, they get frustrated. They were both my lessons were frustrated this morning out there with me because they're not getting it, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk away, they hit one good one, and I say, okay, let's go putt instead of chip. But I still don't have chipping down. No, you're not going to get it in this 15 to 20 minute quadrant.
No,
you're going to get it 2 weeks from now or a month from now.
Yeah.
You'll get it.
Yep.
So, but you have to go to the PGA professional to get the plan and YouTube doesn't always work. It's not individualized.
Correct. YouTube is not going to address your issue.
Right. So, if I want to learn how to change an oil filter, I'll go to YouTube.
Yeah, or you know, something like that. But a golf swing, no sirree, Bobcat.
No,
that's right.
Good stuff, man. Good stuff. So. Great episode, T-Mac.
All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you, all our listeners out there. Thank you, and have a good one. And we look forward to you next Friday.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks,
T-Mac. Yeah, right. Thank you.